Tet Amud Aleph. The Mara that we will study tonight is based on something we made reference to last time. It's on the left-hand side of the page, where it says, the Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, this is left-hand side of the English side of the page, up toward the top, Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, HaTabach Tzarich Shivdok Basimanim Liachar Shchita. The butcher, and remember last time we mentioned that the butcher was also, at that time, the Shochet, Tzarich Shivdok Basimanim. He has to check afterwards the simanim, and the simanim, remember, are the esophagus and the trachea. The trachea is the windpipe, and the esophagus. They must both be cut in order to provide a kosher shechita, and after the shechita is done by the shochet, Shmuel says, "Atavach sarich shivdok pasimanim." You have to check afterwards to see that you've done it properly. The achar shechita, after the shechita is done. Okay, so that's a general statement, and it is with that in mind that the Gemara on the right-hand side of the page goes into a lot of detail. The Gemara says, I'm looking at 9a2, the right side, about halfway down the page. Lo badak mai. Let's say the shochet has not performed that check. What results in that case? Okay? Shmuel said you have to do it, so let's say you don't do it. What is the state of affairs then? Rabbi Eliezer ben Antigonos Mishum Rabbi Eliezer ben Yanai Amar. This Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yanai, says, Treifa va'asura va'achila. Now, treifa, remember what a treifa means. Treifa doesn't mean treif. Maybe we would say treif. Treifa means that we make the assumption that this animal should be dealt with as if it were a treifa. And the definition of a treifa is an animal which upon inspection is found to have some sort of detrimental problem that would lead to its death within a year. Okay? So that's the definition of a treifa. The treifa, therefore, is forbidden. We're not allowed to eat a treifa. And you wouldn't know that until you actually check the animal. But, says our source here, Rabbi Yanai, Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yanai, treifa, this animal that has been slaughtered but not checked is to be dealt with like a treifa. That animal is to be dealt with like a treifa. Ubematnita, bematnita tana, but a beraita teaches something different. In the beraita it teaches nivela umetam'a bimasa. The animal has to be dealt with not as a treifa, but as a nevela. As a nevela. Now, do you remember what a nevela is? A nevela is an animal that has died by any means other than shechita. And there are a variety of such means. The most common means is that it would just die. A dead animal is a nevela.
But doesn't it have to be an animal that would have been kosher?
No. It could be any animal. There are nevelas and there are nevelas. There are nevelas, and I'll read it to you in the Bible in just a moment. There are nevelas that are simply not kosher animals. and then the kosher animals themselves can be nevelis. Okay? And they're dealt with twice, two different portions here in the 11th chapter of the book of Leviticus. And let's just see the way it phrases it. This second point of view, which is a point of view which is from the Baraita, says, Nevela umetam'a b'masa. It is a nevela, and it causes tuma by carrying it. It causes tuma by carrying it. Now, we'll look at this in greater detail in just a moment, but what is it saying? What is it saying is, normally we would assume, we know a little bit about tuma, right? Tuma is a state of something where that thing can convey having some power of death that is associated with it. I think that normally we would assume that the way we convey that power, which is probably the most common way that something that is tuma conveys this numinous, dangerous essence that it has, is through touch. Okay? But let's take another possibility here. Let's say we have something that conveys tuma, and you don't touch it. How could you not touch it? You have a nevela, okay? You have a nevela. It's a dead animal. You come upon this dead animal. You're wearing gloves and long sleeves. And it's winter, and so you have a coat on. Okay? So you go up, and you pick up the animal. Have you touched it or not? What does it need to touch it? Okay? All right, that's the problem here. We assume usually touching means physical touching. But in fact, as far as the nevela goes, physical touching is not the only thing that can convey the tuma of the animal. Okay? Now, let's go to the Bible. We are going to take a look at the 11th chapter of the book of Leviticus. Okay? 11th chapter of the book of Leviticus is Parashat Shmini. And that is where we learn the laws of Kashrut. All right, it says, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the children of Israel. These are the creatures that you may eat from among all the land animals. And then it goes on to say that the animal has to have hoofs with clefts in the hoofs. It has to chew its cud and so on. So we learn that here. Then we get to verse 24. And the Torah says, Ule'ele titam'u, these things shall provide tuma. They shall provide ritual impurity. Kol anogeh b'nivlatam yitma ad ha'aretz. Everyone who touches their carcass, probably meaning really touches, shall be tamei until the evening. And the next verse says, V'chol hanosei me'nivlatam, anyone who lifts their carcass, yichabes begadav, has to wash his clothes, v'tamei ad ha'aref, and that person is tamei until the evening. Okay? ולכל הבהמה אשר היא מפרסת פרסה ושסה איננה שוסעת. Then it goes into detail. Now when it says, every animal that has a split, that has a hoof, but the hoof is not split. Here we're talking about the non-kosher animals. Okay? So we go into detail now, and we might think that really all of this is relating only to the non-kosher animals. Okay? We get further on in the chapter, and we read the following. This is now verse 39. Vechi yamut min ha-behema asher hi lachem le'ochla. If an animal that you can eat dies, hanogeh b'nivlatam yidma ad ha'aref, whoever touches their carcass shall be tamei until the evening. V'ha'ochel minivlata, and he who eats of its carcass, yichabes begadav v'tameh ad ha'aref, shall wash his clothes, and he is tameh until the evening. V'hanoseh et nivlata, and whoever lifts its carcass, Yichabes bigadav, he shall wash his clothes, v'tamei ad ha'aretz, and he is ritually impure until the evening. Okay? So, any reference made to the Nevela, in fact, is going back to this 11th chapter here in the book of Leviticus. And the paradigm now is the sacrificial system. Right? We are in the book of Leviticus, we're in the 11th chapter. We're talking about animals that are brought for sacrifices. And in the middle of the discussion of animals that are brought for sacrifices, we learn about the laws of kashrut. And not only do we learn about the things that you can eat and that you can't eat, but we learn that there is an additional dimension here of tumah, of ritual impurity. And of course, that's crucial for the sacrificial system. Because the only way that you can enter the sacred precincts is if you are tahor, if you are ritually pure. If you are impure, you cannot enter there. So this makes sense within the original context. Now let's go back and see the machloket that we're dealing with. This machloket says that there are two possible ways to deal with the case of the person who has performed shechita and yet has not checked the shechita. Okay? There are two analogies we can create. One is to the analogy of the treifa, and the other is to the analogy of the nevela. Now there is an essential difference between a treifa and a nevela. They're not different in that neither of them can be eaten. Neither of them can be eaten. So from a practical purpose, it doesn't really make any difference. Okay, can't eat either of those animals. But there is a big difference, because the treifa does not convey tumah, whereas the nevela does. Okay? And just keep this in mind. Well, I will speculate in a little while why there is this difference. But it's as if one is a mistake. You've had a potential mistake. And the question is, what do we have to assume as a result of that potential mistake? Actually, not a real mistake, but a potential mistake. We just didn't check. The shochet didn't check. So one point of view, the first point of view is that we treat it like a treifa. And the second one, which is the beraita, is nevela umetam'a b'masa. It is a nevela, and it can convey tumah when you lift it. Okay, now you understand what it means when you can convey tumah when you lift it. That's the essence of the nevela. That's what's so weird about the nevela. And that's the way the Gemara expresses sort of the force of the difference between these two different assumptions. Any questions till here? Yes?
Purification after you touch a nevela lifting it up is just to wash clothes. What about taking a shower?
Yeah, you have to go to the mikveh also.
But they don't say.
No, they don't say. But that's an assumption later on in the laws of tumah.
There is a...
Correct. You'd have to also go to the mikveh. But you can't go to the mikveh until the evening has come.
Okay, it's only in the evening.
Correct. So there has to be a certain period of time that passes. It's Herev Shemesh, it's called in the laws of tumah. Till the evening comes, then you can indulge in the purification, which is the mikveh. Okay? Yes.
When you were reading from, I think it was either verse 11 or 39, mm-hmm. there seemed to be three conditions for the nevela.
Correct, in the latter one.
Yeah, the middle one of which was a nevela that you eat. Yeah. Either in that circumstance, so that seems a little odd.
Where's the nevela that you can eat? It says, V'chi amut min ha-beima she'hi lachem lo'ochla. Doesn't mean that you can eat it. It means this is, in theory, an animal that you might have been able to eat. Okay? Ha-nogeh b'nevelata. So it's just to separate it from the animals, which are the animals that are not the kosher animals. Couldn't be in any circumstance kosher. And then it says, Itma'adar. Ha-nogeh b'nevelata. If you touch it, you're tamei till the evening. Ha'ochel min nivlata. Oh, you're right. If you eat from that nevela, you're also tamei. But in addition, you have to wash your clothes. And the person who simply lifts it also is in the same state. It happens. It happens. It happens, and it could certainly happen in the case that we're dealing with now, which is a case where you're not sure, you didn't look, and it could in fact be, if we're going to treat it as an avail, I'm not saying we should, but we see that's one of the two possibilities that we have here, then you could be in that position if you make a mistake. Okay? The question, we're not telling you you can do it, but if you do do it, you have to go through certain ritual procedures. Okay? Yes?
What is the person supposed to do between the time he does something wrong and the evil?
Have a good time. But you can't go into the temple. It's not what you can do, but it's what you can't do. What?
There's not this concept of you're separating your body.
No. You're not marginalized at all. You're only marginalized insofar as the temple is concerned. Those precincts are forbidden to you.
You
go to prayer, yeah. You go to mincha, no problem. Which is an interesting point. That you can go to mincha. Because we might assume that you would be totally out of the religious realm if you partook in this. But that's not a case.
But in the time of Korbanot, come into the temple.
Correct. In the time of Korbanot, when that was your only option, then in fact, going to mincha meant going into the temple.
Exactly.
At a certain point, we have also synagogues, even contemporaneous. As our speaker said 2 weeks ago, there were contemporaneous synagogues at the time even that the temple stood, so at that point you would have two options. Okay? Yes?
So there's no concept though that this is transferable beyond the person who is Tumah. So if that person touches other people, comes in contact.
Now there is a transferability to it that we did earlier on in our course. Remember the chart that I made for you? And there were certain transferences that were possible. The main transference was a transference because the nevela is what you call an av hatuma. It is a basic form of tuma, and there are certain things that can be made tamei from the av hatuma. But once the av hatuma has touched the person becomes a rishon tuma, a first degree of tuma, and the rishon tuma can't transfer it to another person, let's say. That you can't do. Okay? Okay? Any other questions so far? Okay. Now, first of all, I would hope that you would be saying to yourselves, why would you even raise a question like this? Now, what is the purpose of bringing in ritual impurity when you're dealing with something like a shechita that hasn't been checked? First of all, it's not really all that practical. It doesn't really matter in the world of the rabbis when the temple didn't exist. Sure, it doesn't matter today. It doesn't matter if you're Tamei or not. There's no practical ramification for it in most cases because, as we said, you can daven, you can eat. You can eat, but what you can't do is go into the temple. So, I mean, we have a little bit of a sense of, you know, why the arguments? What's the big deal about this that you have to define the difference between the two. Okay? Now let's go on a little bit. I think Mara then says, Bamai Kamiflage. What is the point that these two are disagreeing about? This is Rabbi Elazar and the Baraita. The Baraita, remember, treats this condition as one of Tuma, one of Nevela. Nevela. Rabbi Elazar treats it as one of Trefa. So why the two different points of view? Bidur Rav Huna. They are disagreeing about how to apply a principle of Rav Huna. The Amar, who said the following. Behema b'chayeha b'cheskat isur omedet. An animal, while it is still alive, is within the chazaka of an isur. It is presumed to be forbidden. Okay? An animal, while it is alive, is presumed to be forbidden. Ad sheyivada, until it will be known, בחזקת חייהם, sorry, בהמה בחייהם בחזקת איסור עומדת, עד שיוודא, until it be known that it is properly slaughtered and is outside then of the state of prohibition. Okay? That seems to be the issue. That seems to be the issue. Let's try to figure out what they're talking about. What they're talking about. Let's read it again. They're differing about a point of view of Rav Huna. Rav Huna says the following. Behema b'chayeha b'cheskat isur omedet. A behema, while it is alive, has an assumption that goes with it that it is prohibited. Okay? Ad shivada, until there be grounds for changing that assumption. Until there be grounds for changing that assumption. Let's go on a little bit further. Ad shivada, lecha b'me nishchata, until it become known, comes known to you in what manner it was slaughtered, namely whether it was properly slaughtered. Okay? Nishchata, once it is slaughtered, harei hi becheskat heter, it is in a permitted state, ad sheyivadamecha b'me nitrefa, until it becomes known to you in what manner it became a trefa. Now, let's take a look at a Rashi here. There's a very important Rashi, I think. This is the Rashi that's... Remember where Rashi is, right? Rashi is on the sort of inner margin insofar as the Talmudic text itself goes. It's the one next to the Talmudic text, always on the toward the margin. And it's about almost three-quarters of the way down the page. Okay? See if you can get about three-quarters of the way down the page. It says, B'chayeha, B'hema b'chayeha, b'cheskat isur. Can you see that? B'hema b'chayeha, b'cheskat isur. Got that?
It's opposite the bottom of the column.
Yeah, that's good. Just about opposite the bottom of the column. Look at the right here, and we'll read it. Shahare asura mishum ever minachai. An animal, while it is live, is prohibited to be eaten because there's a law of the Torah that says Eber Menachai. Eber Menachai is that, excuse me, you cannot eat anything that is alive. You cannot pull a limb from a live animal. Okay? Therefore, while an animal is alive, the Torah has cast on it a prohibition. It's Becheskat Isur. It exists, its state of being is one that prohibits you from it. Okay? Mishum Eber Minachai, because of the law of Eber Minachai, a limb from a living animal. Hilkach, therefore, still reading Rashi, Im Nolad Safek Bishchida, if there is a doubt in the quality of the Shchita that you have performed, Uba'at laha'amida al cheskata. You consider the animal then still to be in the state in which it existed before the shechita. It existed in the state of isur, in the state of prohibition. And therefore it remains in that state of prohibition until you can show that it has changed its status. Sha'arei b'chol davar Ata omer ha'ameh davar al cheskato. This is a general principle of the law. Everything remains in its world of assumption, let's say. That's what chazakah is. A chazakah is an assumption. Okay? The thing remains attached to all of the assumptions that are associated with it. Al cheskata shahaya mitechila. The assumptions that we had from the start. She'ein yachol lahotziya mimena al yedei safek. A doubtful change cannot remove that status from the animal. Until you are sure of that change, the animal has not been removed from one status to another. על ידי ספק נמצאת, אומר שבהמה זו אסורה. And therefore, this animal is asur, it is prohibited, because it maintains its prior state, and it will not transform that state until you can be sure that, in fact, it is no longer a living animal. The definition of that is that it was slaughtered by the laws of Shechita. And if it has not been slaughtered by the laws of Shechita, it's still, from the perspective of the Isur, of the prohibition, it never lost its prior state. Never lost its prior state. Sharei b'cheskat Isur hayata techila. U'misafek ata bala hatira. In it, for a doubt, maybe you did it right, maybe you did it wrong, you're going to remove it and say now that it's permitted, Shema nishchata kara'ui, al telti rena misafek. You cannot permit it on the basis of a doubt. Ad sheyivadalecha shenishchata kara'ui, until it will be evident to you, well known to you, that it has been slaughtered appropriately. Okay? So that's Rashi's understanding of it. Rashi's understanding of this principle of Rav Huna is that things remain in a state of being. And the state of being of a live animal is crucial to what it is. And it cannot be transformed into the next state of being, which presupposes that you're allowed to eat it. We shouldn't be allowed to eat things that are living. Right? There's no reason to eat anything that's living. Unless, of course, the source of all living has given you permission to do it, but he has given you permission to do it only in the following circumstance, namely, that you've done a proper shechita. Until you know that you've done a proper shechita, it remains in its prior assumption. And that assumption was an assumption that was determined by its liveness. Said legally, that the law of Eber Min Achai applied to it. Okay? Yes?
Doesn't this contradict the text we just read, though? The text, I thought, said it's asur when it's alive. When it's slaughtered, it becomes permissible until you find out that the shechita was not properly done.
Wait.
In which case...
No, that's not what it says. Wait a second. Behema bechayeha... A behema, while it's living, the cheskati sorom edit, and is in an assumption of being in a prohibited state, ad sheyivadala chava men nishchata, until it is known to you how it has been slaughtered. Right? That's what Rashi is saying. Until you are sure that it's been properly slaughtered, it cannot transform its state of being. It hasn't become the new thing until you know it. Yes.
But the question here was, what
text? A little ambiguous, because it said, until you know that it was nishkata.
Means karoi, that it was properly stored. Okay. Are you reading the first part of the Brit or the second part of the Brit? Oh, if you read the second part, it's something different. Second part, in fact, is we're not going to be analyzing immediately here, but we'll take the second part for a moment. Nishchata. Once the animal has been slaughtered, right, and that means that it's been properly slaughtered, once the animal has been properly slaughtered, harei hi b'cheskat heter, then we assume that it is permissible, okay, until you may find out that it's a taref after you examine it. But our assumption is that it is in a permissible state until you find any reason to discount it from being in that state. Okay? All of that presupposes that it has made the transition between the cheskat isur and the cheskat eter, the assumption of prohibition, which is from Eber Min Achai, to the cheskat heter, the assumption of permissibility, which is the result of a kosher slaughter.
And not only kosher slaughter.
Well, no, it's kosher until you can prove that it's trefa. Okay.
You cannot eat until you prove that it's not Reva.
Well, but that we don't know yet. That we haven't studied that yet. Either maybe yes, maybe no, but that's not clear. I don't think it's clear from the text. Yes?
But the question I thought they were trying to answer is what is the real machloket between...
Well, we didn't get to that yet. We've got to see what that... They will, in the Gemara that's coming up, articulate what that machloket is.
You're both it's based... consider this a sur.
No, I just explained it one way. There are two ways that you can read this problem of Rav Huna's, the issue raised by Rav Huna. And each of them, namely the Baraita on the one hand, the other one was who, Rav Yehuda? No, it was Ben Eliezer Ben Yonai, no? Rabbi Elazar, the son of Yonai, Rabbi Elazar, right. He says, Trefa ba'asurah ba'achila, and the Baraita says, no, it's a nevela and it's not a trefa. Right? This Rabbi Elazar assumes that the state where we haven't checked, we're going to make an assumption that it's a trefa, and the Baraita makes the assumption not that it's a trefa, but that it's a nevela. We don't know why. They are both going to read this teaching of Rav Huna in two different ways.
But in the Vela is also a surba achila.
Correct.
So here
Both of them say you can't eat it.
Right.
But the question is whether in addition to that there's a state of tumah.
I know. The chazaka this is only telling us that
you can't eat it.
It's asur,
right.
which both of them agree.
Correct. Well, that's what you think. I mean, you think that it's only telling you that. We're going to see the Gemara will say it's going to tell you more than that. At least according to the point of view of the person who reads, who was the source of the Baraita. The Baraita says it's going to tell him more than that. Right? Rabbi Elazar says it only tells me that. Right? The Baraita says, no, it doesn't only tell me that. It tells me something else in addition. Not evident, but we'll see from the Gemara how it is. Okay? Maybe we'll read a little bit more to see how that is. Okay, let's go down a little bit further. We'll read a little bit more, and then we'll go back. Mar Savar, one master. Namely, this is the Tana of the Baraita, who says that it's a Nevela, not the one that you thought. You thought it was just an Isur, right? But this, the one who also thinks that it's a Nevela, the Cheskat Isur Kaima, the animal remains in a prohibited state, right? An animal is always prohibited. The animal remains in that state. But the hashta metahi. But now, in addition to that, it's dead. What do you know is the result of having a dead animal? What is a dead animal by definition? That's not slaughtered by the laws of Shechita. Sinavela. Okay. So because it starts out and it's prohibited, just the way the non-kosher animals are prohibited. Right? Non-kosher animals are prohibited. They're not prohibited until they die, then they're nevelas. Then they're nevelas. So even this one that's prohibited, this is a kosher animal that's also prohibited. Why? Because it's still alive. Now something else happens to it. It dies. Since it's died, it's now the prohibited thing that's dead. The prohibited thing that's dead is called a nevela. So how could you ever have read it that way? That it wasn't a nevela. It's got to be a nevela. Okay? But the other one says, no. It's not a nevela. It's not a nevela. It's just an Isur. You'll see. It goes on. Okay? Umar Savar, the other master, Rabbi Elazar, says, B'cheskat Isur Amrina. It starts out in the state of being prohibited. B'cheskat Tuma la amrina. If we were going to learn that somehow it's going to move to be tuma, it would have said tuma. It just says, that it starts out with an assumption of being a prohibition, prohibited. Prohibited is not the same as tameh. Tameh is a change of some mystical, who God knows what kind of status in that thing. But it never said that. It simply uses the language of isur, of prohibition. And therefore, since it uses the language of prohibition, that's what it's talking about. How do you have any right to introduce something else that's not stated there? Okay? That seems logical.
This inspection is being done by the person who's not the shochet.
It could also be the shochet. It's also because the shochet can check his own work. You can check your own work. Okay? The shochet doesn't need somebody else to check. He has to check his own work.
But whatever, the second explanation, which assumes that it's a trefa, but wouldn't call it an avela, you must be assuming that the shochet, you're giving the shochet the benefit of the doubt.
Giving the shochet the benefit of the doubt?
I mean, well, the animal was slaughtered by somebody who intended to slaughter it, presumably in a kosher slaughter.
Right.
If it's not checked, one person saying it's a nevela, which would mean it's just you're assuming it wasn't given a proper slaughter. The other is saying terefa, which means it would have been a proper, you're assuming almost it's a proper slaughter, but you haven't seen to see if whether there's a tear or some blemish in it.
Correct. Well,
so
and in fact,
you must be assuming that it was a proper slaughter.
It's a little bit more complicated. You're right. It looks like that, but it's not actually that, because, you know, in effect, the word trefa is almost being used as a metaphor here. It's not being used strictly in its legal sense. Because strictly in its legal sense, something is only a trefa once you have found that there is this blemish inside the animal. There's some sort of a problem there. And it can't be that you found that because you haven't found that yet. You haven't checked it yet. Okay? So what it means is we treat it like a trefa. Not that it is a trefa, but we treat it like a trefa. What's the force of that? The force of that is we treat it like a trefa, but not like a nevela. That's the force of it. We're not worried about the fact that it could transmit tumah. It's simply to be treated like a trefa. Okay? The force of which is you can't eat it. That's the only thing that's practically important here. Yes?
I think it gets to the issue of the unobserved as opposed to the observed death. Death that's not observed, the possibilities of what might have happened are infinite. Whereas in this case, you have an observed death, in fact, an induced death, and therefore the potential for problems are ones like the trefa, which is a theoretical assessment of a probability of something happening in the future. So that's what, if I'm looking for a thread here to support this, that would be my sense of it. There's also a sense of, I'm not quite sure, I'm not using this in the most precise way, but the notion of fences is part of what I react to here, meaning trying to build structures that prevent you from even getting close to making a serious mistake, even at the risk of losing the potential to take advantage of something, that trade-off, which I don't think is a trivial trade-off, because if you declare something trefa that really wasn't trefa, then you have the possibility that one of God's creations to support humans is not being used for that purpose. So I don't consider that without real cost.
Right. In
this
there is a cost.
But it's that the risk of that it's a probability, mm-hmm. and the risk of that is so serious that if it occurs, and even if it's an improbable event, it's worth losing that.
I would even go a little bit further and just remind you of the fact that if we're dealing with analogies to the sacrificial system, that as far as the sacrifices go, let's say you have an animal that becomes blemished. You can't use it on the altar. Truth is, you can't do anything with it. You can't do anything with it. That animal, you can't eat it. You what?
You sell it to the gods.
No, you can't do anything with it because it's Kodesh. It's Kodesh, but it can't anymore go on. It's God's now, but it can't go on the altar. So that you have, in effect, this terrible area of once you are dealing with analogies to the sacrificial system, in fact, they're in the state that you say. You can't do anything with them, and because it's in a never-never land. And maybe that's the result of doing what you shouldn't do. And you've got a creature that you shouldn't sacrifice. And yet, you can't eat it, you can't enjoy it. And that's because of the tenuous nature of the life of that creature in the first place. That it's, well, in Kodesh, it's holy. The life is holy. Let's go a little bit further. Take a look on 9A3. The explanation that I gave to you is an explanation based on Rashi. I have read the Rashi. Rashi understands that the chazakah, the assumption, is the assumption of liveness because of the Eber Min HaChai, the law of Eber Min HaChai, and that state continues on until you know that the animal has been properly slaughtered. Okay, and that's the reason why you can't have it afterwards. You can't eat it afterwards. In the English commentary here, the English brings up a very important alternative explanation for why it is, what the chazakah is, and what it is and why it continues. And that is, it brings the explanation of Rashba. Remember, Rashi is a commentator of the 11th century, the very, very beginning of the 12th century, but he's basically an 11th century French commentator. So you're dealing here with European understanding, European meaning north of the Pyrenees. This is the understanding. Rashba is basically a 13th century Spaniard who lived in Barcelona. Okay? Rashba is Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet. Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet. And it is not unusual that we will have different understandings of things. Those of you who were present in the shul, as a matter of fact, the last few days, I've been talking about the mitzvah of the head tefillin, and whether there's one mitzvah of tefillin or two mitzvahs of tefillin. And our customs, as far as the blessings we say, reflect the notion that in the Ashkenazi community, and that is Rashi's explanation, is that there is one mitzvah of tefillin which has two parts to it. Namely, there is a tefillah shel yad and a tefillah shel rosh. Right? There is an arm tefillin and a head tefillin. But there is one mitzvah. According to the Rambam, sorry, no, I got it backwards. That's according to the Rambam. According to the Rambam, there's one mitzvah. One mitzvah. And therefore, when you say the blessing, you say, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Asher Kideshanu B'Mitzvotav B'Tzivanu La'aniach Tefillin. The first one. Before you put on the arm. You put on the head, you don't say any blessing.
According to the Rambam.
According to the Rambam. Put on the head, you don't say any blessing. Why? Because you're simply finishing the mitzvah of tefillin, which you just said a blessing for. Okay? Only reason you would say a blessing according to the Rambam is if you would be interrupted in between the two. If you talk to somebody. If you talk to somebody, then you have to say the second blessing. We Ashkenazim, according to the tradition of Rashi, we understand that there are two mitzvahs of tefillin. One is the tefillin of the arm, and one is the tefillin of the head. And therefore we say two blessings. First we say, Asher kedushanu mitzvotav tzivanu la'aniach tefillin. And on the head we say, Asher kedushanu mitzvotav tzivanu al mitzvah tefillin. But since the Rambam, Maimonides, is so credible and so important, it could be that we Ashkenazim are wrong. Therefore, after we put the tefillin on the head, we say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. Blessed be his name, for his glorious name forever and ever. Why do we say that? Because in case we send a blessing unnecessarily, and it was a mistake, we apologize for it by saying, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. That's our Ashkenazi custom. Okay? So here you see a difference between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. Both are completely reasonable. Both are completely reasonable, but they're geographically different, and these are different differences. There are some practical ramifications. Here, I want you to read now the understanding of the Rashba, which is different from the understanding of Rashi. Again, Rashi says, the Chazakah, the assumption, that the animal stays in is an assumption based on the law of Eber Min HaChai, that you're not allowed to eat a living thing. Right, now let's look here. I'm on the left side, down toward the bottom of the English part of the page, underneath the line. This is 9A3, second paragraph. Right, I'll just read it from the beginning of the paragraph. There is some question about which specific prohibition gives a living animal a forbidden status. Rashi states that we are discussing Eber Min HaChai, the prohibition against eating a limb or meat from a living thing. Since the animal's meat was definitely forbidden for this reason during its lifetime, it remains forbidden until we ascertain that it was slaughtered properly. That's what we've said so far. Rashba objects, however, that this prohibition is definitely lifted once the animal dies, no matter how it met its death. Rashba says, what do you mean? Is this animal alive or dead? Once you slaughter the animal, you mean to tell me that it's alive? How can it be alive? It's dead. That's a good point. He's right. The animal is dead. All right, let's see how he goes. Let's go further. All right, Rashba objects that this prohibition is definitely lifted once the animal dies. So the animal no longer has a prohibition of Eber Min HaChai, the way Rashi said. No matter how it met its death, and it doesn't matter whether it met its death as a kosher slaughter or as a non-kosher slaughter, the fact is it's dead, and everybody knows that. Why should we presume that the meat remains forbidden then after the animal has died? Rashba therefore maintains that the animal has a prohibited status because it is eina zebucha, it is not ritually slaughtered. In other words, when the Torah states that an animal must be slaughtered before it be eaten, it implies that any unslaughtered animal, whether dead or alive, may not be eaten. As such, Rav Huna maintains, we assume that the prohibition remains in place after the animal's death, unless we know that the animal underwent a valid shechita. Let's test this thing out. This is getting to some, I think, interesting philosophical issues. Deuteronomy 12:21. The laws of kashrut appear in two places in the Torah. We have, until now, been talking about the 11th chapter of the book of Leviticus, which is part of the sacrificial system. Okay? When we get to Deuteronomy 12, Deuteronomy 12, verse 20, we begin to see a restatement of the laws of Kashrut in a completely different context. Realize that by Deuteronomy 12, the people of Israel is on the threshold of coming into the land of Israel. And Moses is giving his orations. They're standing near the border of the land. The whole latter part of the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' instruction then at that point in time. And once they move into the land of Israel, while they're traveling in the desert, you've got a Mishkan, right? That's a tabernacle. Everybody is within reasonable distance of the tabernacle. Now, the land of Israel may not be any bigger than the state of New Jersey, but it's still pretty far if you're living in the Galilee if you want to have hamburger for dinner to go to Yerushalayim. The assumption in Leviticus 11 is that all slaughter is done at the Mishkan. It's not until Deuteronomy 12 that we have raised another possibility. When the Lord enlarges your territory, as he has promised, and you say, I shall eat some meat, for you have the urge to eat meat. You may eat meat whenever you wish. If the place where the Lord has chosen to establish his name is too far from you, all right, you may slaughter. You may slaughter, vizavachta. You may slaughter any of the cattle or the sheep that the Lord gives you as I have instructed you.
Why do you say slaughter,
vizavachta?
Slaughter is
shechita. I'm just reading to you what it says here. I'm not translating, I'm reading. כי ירחק ממך המקום אשר יבחר השם אלוקיך לשום שמו שם וזבחת וזבחת okay? You shall slaughter מבקרך ומצונך אשר נתן השם לך כאשר ציביתיך as I have commanded you ואכלת בשעריך and then you can eat within your gates בכל אבת נפשך whenever you have an inner desire. Okay? Okay? This radically transforms the laws of Kashrut. Okay? Laws of Kashrut now become potentially separate from the sacrificial system. Right? However, they're not separate from the divine set of commandments. To the contrary. There is now a zivicha, which we call shechita. We then get a later terminology for it. In fact, a Talmudic terminology, not a biblical terminology, because you pointed out quite correctly that it's a vizavachta. You shall slaughter, which is normally a term used in sacrifices.
Zivachta is to bring to the altar.
Well, normally it is, but here it isn't. Right? This is a context where it defines itself out of that context. Okay? So here suddenly now we have the possibility of another kind of slaughter. Right? Now, this is what Rashba is picking up on. We are not allowed to eat anything unless we follow the laws of the Torah. Unless we follow those laws because of what I just read to you. It's not that it's b'chezkat chayim. It's not that it's still alive, that's the assumption. But the assumption is that it is prohibited. There is only one way that a Jew is permitted to have meat. And that is called shechita. Because that is v'zavachta ka'asher tzivitecha. That is the slaughtering according to the way that I have commanded you. So according to Rashba then, this is the issue. This is the issue. The animal is a dead animal. But it is b'chezkat isur. It's in the status of being prohibited until we know that it has been done properly according to the law. Because other than that, all food is prohibited. All meat is prohibited. There's only one condition which is permissible, and that's when we have done it according to the permissible statute. Okay? So that's really it's a fascinating difference with Rashi. Let me read to you here the Rambam. This is Maimonides now. This is the Hilchot Shechita of Maimonides. And Maimonides starts out as follows. This is chapter 1, Halacha Aleph, the first Halacha. Mitzvat Aseh, it is a positive commandment. Sheyishchot, that the person should slaughter mi sheyirtze le'achol basar behema chaya ba'of. Whoever wants to eat the flesh of a behema, the behemas are cattle and sheep, a chaya, there are possibly permitted other animals which are non-sacrificial animals. You know the one that's permitted? The deer. That's the one that chews its cud and has a split hoof. The oaf. Right? Chickens. Well, it could be any kind of a permissible bird. It's not only a chicken, because there are other permissible birds. Pigeons are permissible birds. Okay? Turkeys are permissible birds. Geese are permissible birds.
You didn't have turkey.
What?
You didn't have turkey then.
Well, they didn't have turkey, but we don't even know what they had. And that's why, according to the laws of Kashrut, the only birds that are permissible, we don't know what any of the birds are in the Torah. We have translations for them all, but we do not know what they mean. And therefore, all the permissible birds are animals, or birds, that we have a tradition concerning. You have to have a tradition. That's why there were communities, and to this day there are communities, where they won't eat geese. Because they had no tradition to eat geese. There are many who will not eat a turkey. Why? Because there was no tradition to eat turkey. Okay? So, but here these are the permissible animals. And it's a mitzvah aseh, a positive commandment of the Torah, sheyishchot, that a person who wants to eat flesh will perform shechita. Va'achar kach yochal. Afterwards you can eat. Shenemar, as it says, v'zavachta mibakarcha u'mitzonecha. What I just read to you. You shall slaughter from your cattle and from your sheep. V'ne'amar b'vechor bal mum, and it is also said vis-a-vis the firstling of the animals that are brought, which is a firstling that has a blemish on it. Ach ka'asher ye'achel et atzive et achayal. This animal can be eaten the way a tzvi, a deer, or an ayel, how do you say ayel?
Ram.
No.
A gazelle.
Halamadeta, therefore you learn, shechayaki behema le'inyan shechita. You learn that a chaya, one of the non-domesticated animals, which nonetheless fits the bill according to the simanim, the signs, the physical signs of the animal, that it chews its cud and it has a split hoof, that animal also has to have shechita. Uba'of huomer, and as far as birds go, it says, asher yatsud seid chaya o'of. An animal that is literally hunted, but an animal is what?
Not killed through the hunting. Because if you kill the hoof, it's
correct. Captured. A chaya or an oaf, a chaya being the deer again, and the oaf now being, extending this category now to a bird. Vishafachat damo, and you kill it, you spill its blood, namely you kill it. That equates the blood of the bird to the blood of the chaya. So all of those then require shechita, even though the Torah itself only said shechita for the behemoths. Right? By extension, then, we extend the notion of shechita to all these three categories. Hilchot shechita b'chulan achat hein. In all of these, it's the same law of shechita. Lefichach ha-shochet behema o chaya o of, whoever slaughters any of these animals, mivarech techila asher kedeshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al ha-shechita. He has to say the blessing first, was sanctified us by his commandments and commanded us concerning shechita. Im lo berach, if he did not say the blessing, ben the shogeg, ben the mesid, whether it be because he forgot or intentionally, habasar mutar, still you can eat the meat. You're supposed to say it, but if you do it without doing it, it's same thing is true of tefillin. If you don't say the blessing, still you fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin, but you're supposed to say the blessing. Okay? Okay. Questions still here? Yes?
I think that's
a view where you could bring up something like fish and like a direct opposite of what we're talking about here, and something you're hearing, you're saying that it's not just be given, that it would be kosher, and you have to do things special to make it kosher, but fish, I think, is the opposite, that there's nothing special. Very good. That's the next thing I wanted to bring up, is fish. So now we've seen three possibilities, namely the behema, the chaya, and the of. What about fish? Do we have shechita for fish? We don't have shechita for fish. So the question is, why don't we have shechita for fish? Okay?
Can't find the drink.
They're dead by the time you intend to pull them out of the water.
Okay, they're dead by the time you pull them out of the water. What if they're not?
They're just get underwater.
Okay.
They don't have an air pipe.
They don't have it? So you're saying that the reason is physical.
Well, I'm just saying, staying.
Gills don't.
Okay, they have gills.
Yeah, they have gills, but they don't have a single.
Okay.
Well, if we're talking about a merciful kind of quick killing, you could also stipulate that to legislate that there is a God, they have to be killed.
That's true. If the laws of Shechita began with that, you could extrapolate and you would go there. But how do the laws of Shechita begin? They begin with the Torah. The Torah says, "V'zabachta k'moshe tzivitecha, you shall slaughter as I have commanded you." They don't begin with any logic.
So I guess the fish is very different than anything they brought as a sacrifice.
So that's an important. Very interesting. That is an important point to make. Fish were not brought as sacrifices, but of course we know that deer were also not as brought as sacrifices. A chicken was not, although birds were. The dove was brought as a sacrifice. You can bring a dove as a sacrifice. Okay? So the birds then are sorted in the intermediary stage, and fish are a little bit pushed over, a little bit further. Let's skip ahead in the Masechet to Daf Kaf Zayin Amud Bet. Page 27b. 27b2. 27b2. Since I wasn't sure whether we would get to this.
That's like 10 years from now.
Here is
the there were no fish in the desert.
Seeing our own future here.
Like,
wait a minute,
I'm
not guarantee we're not going back.
Like,
we're
going
back.
Okay.
I can't even find it. I can't do this. It's Russian. Only A2. B2? Okay, I keep looking.
Just a second. My source. Okay, let's see.
The guild allows me shechita, you know.
Okay. Now let's start at the bottom on the left side. And you'll see the way, we're sort of jumping ahead here, but I think it's interesting to see the way in which analogies are created. Remember, analogies are very important as far as interpretation of the Torah goes. We just saw certain analogies that were connected to the Behema and the Chaya. There was a connection between them. Instead of the law being a development of, let's say, a rational process based on perhaps an ethical idea, which is what you were suggesting before, that's not the way it will work. The source of the law usually is Scripture. Depends on what the Scriptures say. And the way in which Scripture formulates an idea is also frequently crucial in understanding what the law will be that develops out of Scripture. Okay? So if we take from the bottom, the Gemara is going to analyze Leviticus 11:46. Oh, let's see. Leviticus 11:46. I'll read that one to you for a second. I think the whole thing is there, but I'm not sure. Okay, at the end of the 11th chapter of Leviticus, where there's a summing up made of the laws of kashrut, this is what it says. Zot Torat HaBehema V'Ha'Of. This is the law of the behema, cattle, V'Ha'Of, and the bird. V'Chol Nefesh HaChaya, and every living Chaya. Now there, we're understanding it as a Chaya, namely the other kosher animals that fit the bill. Haromeset v'mayim, those who swarm in the waters. Ulechol nefesh hashoretzet ala aretz, and every living thing that swarms on the earth. The latter part of the verse, what are we including here? Those that swarm in the water are called?
Fish.
Okay. We have laws of fish. We see that the fish, earlier on, you know what those laws are. The fish have to have fins and scales. Alright, so in the summing up verse now, reference is made first to the behemoths, then to the chaya and the oaf, and then to the fish, and then finally, l'chol nefesh hasharetzet al ha'aretz. All the living things that swarm on the earth, insects, because there are kosher insects. Right? There are types of locust or grasshoppers that the Torah itself lists as kosher insects. So in Syria, again, unless we have a tradition, we don't know what they are. We don't know what they are and we don't eat them. But if we have a tradition, and there are Jewish communities that have had this tradition, where they know what the kosher insects are. There is a lot of anatomical information here in this tractate, but we don't depend upon that unless we have a tradition as well.
So I was in the Negev, and there is I've got the group, but there was a group of, I think they're Sephardic Jews, who either, I've got what the insect was, but they...
Perfectly fine. Sure. We Ashkenazim have no such traditions, but it's in theory possible. Now, what I am pointing out to you here is this summary statement at the end of the laws of Kashrut. Zot Torat Behema V'Ha'Of V'Chol Nefesh HaChaya Rameset B'Mayim. So the Behema first, then the Chaya, and the Of, the bird, and everything that swarms in the sea, and everything that swarms on the earth, right? Including now the insects. La'avdil ben ha-tameh ben ha-tahor, to separate between that which is tameh and which is tahor, ritually pure. Uvein ha-chaya ha-ne'echelet, between the animal that is eatable, consumable, uvein ha-chaya she-lo te'achel, and the animal which may not be eaten. Okay? That was our verse there, and that's what is going to be made reference to right here. Tani Bar Kappara. Bar Kappara taught. Zot Torata Behema V'Ha'Of. this is the law of the behema and the oath. They are juxtaposed one with the other in that verse I just read to you. Hitila katuv la'oth bein behema ledagim. Scripture has inserted the bird between the behema and the dagim and the fish. L'chayavo b'shnei simanim i'efshar. It is impossible to say that this requires the bird to have the same two-pipe requirement as the behema. Shefar hukash ledagim, because the oaf is next to fish. The behema is on one side, then comes the oaf, then comes the fish. So the laws of kashrut, the oaf is in between. It learns maybe something from the behema, and it learns maybe something from the oaf. So the laws have got to be different for the one that's in between. Lefotro b'li klum i'efshar. It is impossible to say that it doesn't require, the oaf, the bird, doesn't require any kind of a slaughtering, because you might have said, well, we learn from the fish that a bird doesn't require any kind of a slaughtering. Well, why does that not work? Because it's next to the behema in the verse. It's in between the two, so you can't say it requires no slaughtering. Shekvar hu kash le behema. It's analogized to the behema. Haketzad. So what do we do? Hichshiro b'siman echad. Well, there is a way that if the bird is slaughtered with only one siman, it's more lenient. More lenient for the bird. Then the Gemara goes on and it says, Dagim. How do we know that fish don't require slaughtering in the first place? In this previous argument, we were assuming that fish don't require to be slaughtered. Well, how do we know that? How do we know that fish don't require being slaughtered? Perhaps we can say that it is because where in the book of Numbers it says, can sheep and cattle be slaughtered for them? Imet called the Geya Yam Yeaseflahem, or all the fish of the sea be gathered for them. Ba'asefa ba'alma sagilaho. Gathering is enough for the fish. This is Numbers 11:22. This is after the people complain that they have no meat. Right? They want meat to eat. They're simply eating manna. And the manna is not tasty. Well, at least they don't think it's tasty. They want meat. Moses said, the people who are with me number 600,000 men, yet you say I will give them enough meat to eat for a whole month? Remember, God says that to Moses. Could enough flocks and herds be slaughtered to suffice for them? Let me read that. Hatsonu vakar yishachet. Shchita. The word is used yishachet. Can enough tzon uvakar, sheep and cattle, be slaughtered? Umatzalahem. And be enough for them? Im et kol degeayam yeyasethlahem. Or could all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them? Now, what are the fish of the sea are gathered, whereas the behemoths and the tzon are slaughtered? Okay, you get it? So the law of Shechita applies only, therefore, to the behemoths and the chaya, and the oaf by we knew that from the other source before. And here, the fish are referred to only as being gathered. Gathering is enough for the eating of the fish. Okay, that is the source. Yes.
I have an issue with that, because in the middle of the desert, it's a little bit difficult
to get fish.
So if Moses argues with God about
the
food supply to 600,000 people, Moses was a little bit practical man. He couldn't gather any fish there. So why fish come into the argument in the middle of the desert?
They got the quail.
Was it quail?
They were necessary. They might have been. They were near the... I mean, they were in the Sinai. They were down near... There's water. I mean, they're surrounded by the Red Sea.
Not in Mount Sinai.
But they were going all over.
Practically, he'd been to the Nabataean cities in the desert, in the Negev. I've not been to Petra, Professor Nabataean city, too. I've been to Abdat, go to the city of Abdat, for example, in the Negev. It's a Nabataean city. Who were the Nabataeans?
Fishermen.
They were traders.
They were traders.
The traders that moved all the way along from the water. We're in trading. The key to trading is that you get things from the water. Right? Big trade is from the water. And then you take them over land. Take them over a land route and you sell them. All of these things in those days and as today. Where you get things doesn't necessarily mean, because you're in the desert doesn't mean that you don't have access. That desert isn't the moon. Right? There is access to all kinds of stuff. And if we see right back here in the book of Leviticus, we have the laws of fish in the book of Leviticus. So that obviously there must have been a possibility of getting fish, or there would be no loss of fish, right? I mean, I think it's evident. So that there must have been a possibility. So there are laws of fish, and here we see that they are within the parameters of what people understand. Even some of the skins that we have are skins of fish. The Tachash.
They're near the Mediterranean.
Okay, they're near the Mediterranean. You're near the Mediterranean, you're near the Red Sea. All of this is part of that complex economy. And therefore, they're real. This is real stuff. Okay? Yes?
I want to go back to...
Go ahead.
The death.
Yes, that's where I'm going also.
Okay. So, what struck me is that it's the first interpretation is correct. You might be in a very uncomfortable position of having a definition of the death of a human different from the death of an animal. So I wanted to ask, I know that the view of death is lack for humans, is a lack of breathing, if I got that correct. And so I wanted to go back and ask, in the Talmud, is there discussions of when a human is dead? And then, again, we're back to this issue, if you're going to define the death of an animal as requiring shkita, that would then wind up with two different definitions of death. The human.
Yeah, I don't want to get too involved in that because you know that this is a very hot subject, what is the definition of death? This week's Jewish Week again has another article on it. I saw it on the internet before, where Rabbi Tendler, disagrees with many of the other rabbis because he accepts the notion of brain death as opposed to a limited definition of death having to do with breathing and heartbeat. But you're quite right that there is a difference between the human definition and the definition of the animal. And the animal is not to know so much when the animal is dead as to when we consider the animal to be shachut, slaughtered. That's the key thing.
Okay, but okay? Then that first interpretation was predicated on, or at least the way it was said in English, sounded like it was predicated on defining death as succeeding.
I don't think they go that far. It's not an issue, really, because the definition depends upon observing the simanim, observing the trachea and the esophagus, that in fact they've been properly cut. So if that's happened, you don't have to check anything else. Okay? Certain assumptions come as a result of that.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Yes?
I'm kind of puzzled because I always feel that Rashi is just sums it up so brilliantly. Do you have any explanation as to why you think Rashi seems to not, or says something that seems obviously illogical? It doesn't seem like Rashi.
I think Rashi's terrific here, as everywhere else. And let me just give you a defense of both of these positions. We've seen two positions. One, the position of Rashi, and the other, the position of Rashba. Rashi is based on an assumption of the animal being prohibited. And just imagine what's involved with that. What's involved with that is that we're not allowed to kill a living thing. Right? And all of the claims to the sacred nature of the living thing continue until we can prove that, for our purposes, that it has been slaughtered properly. I think, in essence, both of these guys are agreeing. From a practical perspective, you can't eat the animal until it's been a proper kosher slaughter. Both of them agree with that. There's no question about that. It's just that the Rashba is introducing, you know, the reality is that the animal is dead. The animal is dead. And he is emphasizing the notion of shechita, that shechita is the key thing. And everything stays in its state until it's passed through shechita. So it's not what it was that it was living, but that it has passed through the only permissible state, which is that method of passage, which is shechita. Okay. But I think we are seeing here are a few things. And also I would add one other dimension. We brought up, and we had this discussion, we started, remember, with two different points of view. We started with a point of view that talked about this being simply an isor, a prohibition. The other point of view was that, not, it was not only an Isor, but there was a question of Nevela. Right? There was a question of Tuma that was associated with this. A few reflections on that. I think what we are seeing here is really almost at the heart of the problem of eating meat. There's a problem with eating meat. It is, why should we be able to eat meat? Why should we be able to slaughter? God creates living things, and I can well imagine a point of view which would say that all living things have to be preserved. There are, for example, many religions that follow that. In Hinduism, for example, one major perspective in Hinduism is that you cannot eat meat. I don't know a lot about the subject, did a little bit of research on the subject. I told you that I frequently think that some of these issues really can best be understood when seen the perspective of something that's really radically different. And Hinduism sometimes is the best perspective, I think, for understanding the laws of Tuma and Tara, because the Hindus still have those laws. If you go to India, there is a state of ritual impurity which is crucial for them in their lives. Some people are always ritually impure, and they are therefore shunned in that society. But vegetarianism, which is really the alternative here, vegetarianism frequently is an ideal in, not in all of Hinduism, because as you know, you have Indian restaurants that are meat restaurants, but you also have Hindu restaurants, which are vegetarian. There are basically three reasons the Hindus give. One is non-violence. Right? That you should not be violent toward any living thing. Two is the intention to offer only pure vegetarian food to the deity. Right? The deity only gets pure vegetarian food. I'll get back to this in a moment. And the third, that it's not healthy. Okay? Those seem to be the three reasons. The second reason introduced, both the first and the second reasons are quite interesting, I find. One is violence. And in fact, that keeps coming up in the laws of kashrut. Whether these laws are to minimize the violence, to minimize pain. You heard when we heard the shochet, you saw that he was very concerned about that. The violence of the shochet, that the shochet has to be the tzaddik, who is not made coarse by the experience of shechita. Actually, I think that that's relevant here. Number two, it's fascinating to me that in Hinduism, there is a notion of what they call prasad. Prasad is that you give something to the gods. That's why the Hindus give vegetables or flowers to the gods. Because you have given it to the god, it can then be given back to you. Realize the connection between this and Leviticus 11. Right? What you offer on the altar, you can also eat. Okay? It's a variation on this same notion that that which you offer, you can in fact have back. And it's only what you offer that you can have back. I've said it before at the beginning of this course that I think that the laws of kashrut operate somewhere in this zone of dealing with cruelty and nonviolence and the zone of tuma and tahara, of ritual purity and impurity. And I think you saw it tonight. We started out with a halachic problem, and immediately that problem branched out to purity and impurity, and then the transference of something from a living state to a non-living state. And I think that what you see manifested here is the problematics of the thing. It's just such a problematic thing to do, to move from one state to the other. On the one hand, maybe it's because it induces tumah. Right? That was the one possibility. Maybe it's because, here, it's Rashi's point of view, that you're not allowed to kill living things. Okay? But then what Rashba is saying is that the Torah gives you warrant to do it. That therefore you're only allowed to do it because the Torah gives you such warrant.
Are you commanded to do it? I mean,
that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Being a vegetarian
let me say what the Shochet said. If you listen to the Shochet when he was here, he said you're commanded to do it. I don't agree with that. I don't think that that's true. I think you are allowed to do it, not commanded to do it. It's a big difference. Because it seems to me that you don't have to eat meat, and the Torah never tells you to eat meat, but it says, if you want to eat meat, right? That was what we were reading in Deuteronomy before. If you have the desire for meat, vizavachta, you shall slaughter the way I have instructed, kemoshe tzivitecha. Okay?
You could also say from manna. God gave the manna, and the whales only came after they complained.
And remember the story of Genesis. The story of Genesis, God creates the world, and God gives Adam and Eve only the permission to eat vegetables. It is only after the story of Noah that is extended then to animals, and there we have the law of Eber Min Achai, that you're not allowed to eat the limb of a living animal. Okay? But that's not the ideal situation. The ideal situation is the vegetarian paradise. But the Torah compromises.
The sacrifice that's offered a thing by itself.
That's different. That is different. You're right. There is, well, and it's not only that. There's also required sacrifice. So there is no doubt about the fact that there is obligatory sacrifice. Right? There's no doubt about that.
You can't use vegetables.
You cannot use it. You cannot, that's interesting. Yes, you cannot use vegetables. You have to use the animals. Because the key thing on the altar, remember what the key thing on the altar is? It's blood. It's blood. Blood is the key thing of the altar.
And on Pesach, you're obligated to eat the Korban Pesach.
Correct.
So there are times when there's not an absolute 100% revulsion at the idea of...
Correct. Well, later, yes, it is true that once we have the Passover, there is this limited obligation to eat. But in theory, that's all. As far as I can see, that's all. Be continued.
Because I was confused as with the rules of the...